National, the Canadian American National. We have not heard the Canadian Prime Minister or the President name that person, the Australian. These are six international aid workers plus a Palestinian aid worker. Clearly, that's what's changing that conversation, because as you pointed out, almost 200 aid workers have been killed in the last months. You're planning to go back to Gaza? You are Palestinian American. Are you concerned you too, like so many of your colleagues, could be targeted as a doctor, as a nurse, as a medical aid worker in Gaza?
I mean, of course, that's always a primary concern. I think it's because we have the same realization that most other agencies and organizations and relief workers have, and that there's no place that's safe in the Gaza Strip. Again, World Central Kitchen, when Jose Andreas is saying that route was deconflicted, he's saying that the coordinates and the movement were shared in real time with the Israeli military. And this is an organization that has an excellent relationship with the IDF. And the fact that their convoy was hit three separate times, despite them trying to reach out, nobody's safe. I mean, you know, there's about 200 aid workers that have been killed, but also 400 healthcare workers. You know, this is journalists, over 100 journalists have been killed in this process. There is nobody that's safe. And I think one comment that I want to make that Chef Jose had really mentioned is anything that moves. And that's such an important thing for people to recognize in the Gaza Strip, that there are areas where there is total control by the Israeli military. And if there's any sort of movement, those people come under fire and are killed. And there is a footage just from last week of two Palestinians on the beach waving the white flag. We can clearly see that they're unarmed, and them being killed and then buried with a bulldozer on the beach in Gaza. I mean, that's the kind of landscape that you're talking about. This is, there's so many different areas in the Gaza Strip where you cannot walk around, does not matter, man, woman, or child, and you are under the threat of attack. And so it's everybody, it's all parts of society, aid workers, healthcare workers. So it's important for people to recognize and understand the counter narrative here to anything that would suggest that there are armed people or militants that are being targeted. Every single person in the Gaza Strip is not safe. And if they're moving at the wrong place at the wrong time, they will be killed. There's no other conclusion or outcome of that scenario.
Dr. Thayer Ahmed, we want to thank you for being with us, emergency room physician who spent 3 weeks in Gaza volunteering at Al-Nasser Hospital in Khan Yunis, board member for Med Global, which has an office in Gaza, is working with the World Health Organization. He walked out of a White House meeting with President Biden this week. Next up, we speak with a prominent Israeli professor about how Israel put Gaza on the road to famine. Back in 20 seconds.
I got your letter today, and I miss you all so much here. I can't wait to see you all, and I'm counting the days here. I still believe that there's gold at the end of the world, and I'll come home to Illinois on the day.
Day After Tomorrow by Phoebe Bridgers, an artist for Ceasefire. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
A group of U.S. officials at USAID have privately warned the Biden administration that the spread of hunger and malnutrition in Gaza is, quote, unprecedented in modern history, and that parts of Gaza are already experiencing famine. This comes as several aid groups are suspending work in Gaza after Israel killed seven aid workers with World Central Kitchen earlier this week. In a moment, we'll speak to prominent law Israeli professor Liev Gordon about the famine in Gaza, but we begin with the words of two Palestinian mothers. This is Khulud Al-Masri speaking at the Al-Awda Health Center in Rafah, where her children are being treated.
I feel like my children will die in front of my eyes. What can I say? I don't know what I am to do. I can feel them dying before my eyes. This is my daughter. It's been 5 days she is without food or drink. I don't know what to do for her. I am suffering, sitting with my children. I am tired with them. It's two of them, not just one. There's not food or milk available. The girl is suffering from malnutrition. She is tired. The situation is so difficult. I am tired. I swear I am very tired. Their condition is very bad. My daughter is suffering in front of me and I don't know what to do for them. I am unable to provide them with milk or Pampers or food. I don't know what to do for them. The two of them are so unwell. This one, my daughter, has been like this for 5 or 6 days.
That was a Palestinian mother named Khulud Al-Masri. And this is another mother named Reem Al-Qadi, who spoke as she held her crying baby.
My daughter is ill, and she is suffering from malnutrition, and her blood is weak. We, of course, in the hospital are suffering from a catastrophic health situation, very bad. There is no drinking water at all. The hospital is suffering and unable to provide water for us to give to our children. Our children have come here, not to get better and healthier, but their health situations have gotten worse. Most medications are not available. Healthy food is not available for our children. Healthy water is not available for our children. On one bed, they put 3 and 4 cases, which result in the children infecting each other and making their situations worse than before. Of course, all of this is because of the Israeli occupation, the situation which we are in. They bombed hospitals. They tell us a hospital is a safe space. The hospital now is not a safe space. Most hospitals are no longer in service. All the sick are now being treated in 1 or 2 hospitals in the whole of the Gaza Strip. This is really a difficult situation, and we ask all countries, the world, to take our side and relieve us of this situation. It's enough. Our children are dying in front of us, and we are unable to do anything for them.
That was a Palestinian mother named Reem Al-Qadi speaking at a hospital in Rafah. We go now to London, where we're joined by Niamh Gordon, Professor of International Law and Human Rights at Queen Mary University of London, Chair of the Committee on Academic Freedom for British Society of Middle East Studies. He's the author of several books, including Israel's Occupation and co-author of Human Shields, A History of People and Line of Fire. He's co-editor of Torture, Human Rights, Medical Ethics, and the Case of Israel. And he just wrote a piece in the New York Review of Books. It's headlined The Road to Famine in Gaza. Professor Gordon, thanks so much for being with us. Why don't you take us on that journey? Tell us the antecedents to what we're seeing today, the issue of famine in Gaza.
So perhaps I'll begin with what we're seeing and then move back. We're seeing destruction and we're seeing massive displacement in an area that's already food insecure. And then we're seeing Israel obstructing aid from entering Gaza. So on average, in the past 6 months, 112 trucks have been entering per day, while before October 7th, 500 trucks were entering each day. We're seeing consistent attacks on aid workers, as you mentioned in the previous item, with on average one aid worker being killed every day. And we're seeing the destruction of one third of the agricultural land in the Gaza Strip, 20% of the greenhouses, and 70% of the fishing vessels in the Gaza Strip. So no internal food can be produced in the Gaza Strip. And as you mentioned earlier, what we're witnessing and what Reem and Khulud have just expressed is the most horrific situation a parent can experience, is their children dying in front of them of famine. Now, what we wrote, Muna Haddad and me, is about the history of using food as a weapon in the Gaza Strip. So if in 1967 Israel occupies the Gaza Strip, Its approach is very different in the beginning. It surveys the Gaza Strip. It counts the agricultural land. It looks what the Palestinians are planting. And in the beginning, what it does is it actually plants trees and provides the Palestinians with better varieties of seeds. And it monitors the food basket of the Palestinians. And in its reports, it tells us that there's the food basket in 1966 was 2,400 calories per person. And after 4 years of occupation, it's now 2,700, basically boasting about the improvement in the food basket. But what we see already then is that that Israel's controlling the Palestinian food basket. And in the beginning, it wants to kind of increase the productive energies of the Palestinians so they can work in Israel as cheap laborers and extract their labor for Israel's use. Everything begins to change in the first Palestinian Intifada in December 1987, where Israel begins imposing restrictions on the Gaza Strip, first by creating magnetic cards that monitor the entrance of laborers into Israel and restricts the entrance of laborers to Israel. It also, a few years later, creates a fence and fences the Gaza Strip so that and creates only 4 or 5 crossings. And later on, with the Second Intifada, we see a total reversal of the approach after 1967. We see Israel destroying agricultural land. We see it creating a buffer zone around the fence so that Palestinians, farmers cannot get near the fence. We see it destroying fishing vessels, and we see it limiting further the Palestinian food basket. Then comes 2005, Israel unilateral withdrawal from the Gaza Strip, the movement of its soldiers to the fence, but the beginning use of the drones over the Gaza skies. And after Hamas wins in democratic elections in the Gaza Strip, we see the implementation of a blockade where Israel basically blocks the Gaza Strip and monitors very carefully what enters and what exit. It further destroys more agricultural land, and then it creates the Ministry of Defense with the Ministry of Health, creates lists of items that can enter the Gaza Strip and items that cannot enter. So flour and baby formula can enter, but chocolate and certain kinds of pastas cannot enter. And Israel begins to monitor the calorie intake of the population and creates what's called a humanitarian minimum. We will allow, Israel says, a humanitarian minimum to enter the Gaza Strip, leaving the population regularly in a situation of food insecurity and controlling and managing the population through food insecurity. And every time there's a cycle of violence, and there's been 5 major cycle of violence since 2008 until today, Israel closes off all the borders, and what had been a food insecurity before the cycle of violence drops dramatically, and we see incidents of malnutrition and so forth. And so this is kind of the background of what we've been seeing. And when this war begins, so we see that everything you've been describing earlier is intentional, because Israel has been controlling the food basket and using it as a weapon since the beginning of the occupation until today.
And Professor Niamh Gordon, you make the case in your article that, and this is perhaps one of the most surprising things, that Israel has made no attempt to conceal its policy of restricting food to Gaza. You cite Sarah Roy's earlier piece in the New York Review of Books, quoting her citation of a cable sent from the U.S. Embassy in Tel Aviv to the Secretary of State on November 3rd, 2008. The cable reads, "As part of their overall embargo plan against Gaza, Israeli officials have confirmed to embassy officials on multiple occasions that they intend to keep the Gazan economy on the brink of collapse without quite pushing it over the edge." So if you could elaborate on that and what you understand the justification of that to be, and why they were so, why they would be so disclosive about it to the Americans.
So what we see is we see a process from Oslo where Oslo was sold to the public as a peace process that will bring economic dividends for Israel and the Palestinians. And if you remember at the time, Gaza was described as the new Singapore, and we will make Gaza thrive, and there will be a Singapore in the Middle East. Now, what we see in the years immediately after the Oslo Accords were signed, that indeed Israel was enjoying the economic dividends in the Gaza from the Oslo Accords, but the Palestinians, both in the West Bank and in Gaza, and particularly in Gaza, the economic situation drops because Israel is basically strangling the Palestinian economy. And if you mention Sarah Roy, then I will use her concept of de-development. Israel de-develops the Gaza Strip, destroying the agricultural land, destroying the factories, and it is not shy in doing so. It is basically asserting its control and letting the Palestinians in Gaza know who is the lord of the land, and letting the American counterparts also know who is the lord of the land. And through this, we see a situation where the economics, the major reason for the food insecurity in the Gaza Strip before this war was indeed the blockade. But the blockade, what it does, it strangles the Gaza Strip economically. So a year before the war, we have a GDP per capita in the Gaza Strip of about $1,000 per person, while in Israel it's $52,000. An hour away, this is before the war, an hour away from my apartment in Beersheba, where I used to live, and Gaza Strip, that's the distance between the two regions. Yet in the Gaza Strip, a newborn is 7 times more likely to die than in Beersheba because the social detriments of health, because the economic strangulation, because of the lack of health care, and so forth. And the message was clear from the beginning. We control you. If you do not bow down, then we will hit you harder. And that's what Israel has been doing for years in the Gaza Strip, and that's what it's been, and the Americans have been watching, Americans have been seeing this happen, and the Americans have not said anything to Israel in this sense and not stopped Israel's actions. And then we have October 7th, and we've seen what's happened since then.
Well, Professor Nev Gordon, we have to break here, but we want to ask you to stay after the show so we can continue this conversation. We'll post it online at democracynow.org. Professor Gordon teaches international law and human rights at Queen Mary University of London. We'll link to your piece in the New York Review of Books headlined "The Road to Famine in Gaza." Next up, we go to Senegal, where a pair of opposition leaders went from prison to the presidency and the prime ministership in 3 weeks. Stay with us. We'll be right back. Pambela Mama, Mother's Prayer by Mukumba. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
We end today's show in Senegal, where the newly inaugurated president, Bassirou Diomaye Faye, has named Ousmane Sonko to be his prime minister, capping a remarkable three-week period that saw the two opposition figures go from prison to ruling Senegal, vowing to fight poverty, injustice and corruption. Faye and Sonko were released from prison in mid-March, just days before Faye won Senegal's election to replace President Macky Sall, who'd attempted to delay the vote. Faye was officially inaugurated Tuesday.
Le Sénégal sous mon magistère.
Under my leadership, Senegal will be a country of hope, a country at peace, with an independent justice system and a strengthened democracy. This is my promise, based on the oath I have just taken before God and the nation in your presence. I am aware that the results of the ballot box express a profound desire for systemic change. Through my election, the Senegalese people have committed themselves to building a fair Senegal, a prosperous Senegal, a progressing Africa.
Faye is now Africa's youngest elected president and announced in a televised speech Wednesday he'll audit Senegal's oil, gas and mining sectors after vowing to renegotiate contracts with oil giants like BP. For more, we go to the capital of Senegal, Dakar, to speak with Ibrahima Kane, a Senegalese lawyer and political analyst, and Aminatou Touré, Senegal's former prime minister. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Thank you so much for joining us. Let's begin with former Prime Minister Aminatou Touré. A few weeks ago, we spoke to you when you were detained in the mass protests against President Sall trying to delay the elections and extend his term. Can you talk about what happened in this last few weeks? The new prime minister and president were just in prison. This is quite a moment for Senegal. Aminatou Touré, if you could first respond. Aminatou Touré,
This struggle. Yes. Thank you for having me. We have to backtrack a little bit for further context. President Macky Sall, 2 days ago, delayed his response when he was asked whether he's going to run a third time. This triggered massive demonstration, unfortunately, with life lost. And then finally, last year, he decided to drop the ball. But yet, when we were about to start the electoral campaign, he postponed the election to December. This triggered, again, a massive demonstration. I was arrested during the first march. And at the end, he had to submit himself to the decision of the Constitutional Council. So what this means is that although our democracy has been shaken, the foundation remained quite solid because at the end, democracy prevailed. We went to election and Bassirou Diomaye Faye and Ousmane Sonko got freed. They campaigned for the rest of the campaign because when we started, they were still in jail. And today, as you said, Bassirou Diomaye Faye has been sworn as president, and Ousmane Sonko, he appointed Ousmane Sonko as his prime minister. So the lesson to be learned is that, first of all, democracy is not all given. You have to nurture it. You have to be vigilant. We have to alert, and we have to stand by democracy. And that's the lesson that I learned from these months of struggle.
Ibrahima Kane, if you could respond to the remarkable inauguration this week of Bassirou Diomaye Faye, what do you think the significance of this is? And if you could give us some background on who he is.
Well, Bassirou Diomaye Faye is a civil servant. I think he works for the Senegalese administration. With Ousmane Sonko, they decided to create a political party which is called PASTEF, and to confront the system, as they call it, to make sure that the system works better for the citizen. Because in Senegalese democracy, as we used to see it, the system used to work for those who are in power. The system used to work for those who manage to get power, to hold on in power, and they do everything for themselves, forgetting the population. And this is a young generation of Senegalese who really want to shake up the system, as they said, and to really make sure that the system works for the citizen, as we always hope that in a democratic system, this, the citizen should be the first. The citizen should be at the heart of any public policy. Now, Jomai and Sonko are now in power. There is a lot of hope from citizens, not just to sort out their problem. And there is a lot of problem in Senegal. Even yesterday in his speech, he said Senegalese are brave, but really they are very, very tired. They are very, very hungry, and there is a need to sort out their problem. And this is where I think the problem will come very soon, because there is the willingness of the two leaders to sort out problem. But is the Senegalese economy, is the Senegalese education system, is the Senegalese social system able to allow him to find job, to allow him to sort out some of these economic problems? I really doubt it. I really doubt it, because the state that they inherited is the state completely down, completely down. And they have only 5 years. And I doubt that in 5 years, you can really change, you can really make a shift in the Senegalese economic political system. But I do hope that they will start taking specific action that will show to the population that at least this generation of leaders are more inclined to help the population than to help themselves. I think that's where the line is.
And finally, former Prime Minister Aminata Touré, they ran as Pan-Africanists. The significance of what they're talking about when it comes, as Ibrahima was talking about, education, where women stand in this government in this final minute that we have.
Well, first of all, I like to say that I'm a little bit optimistic that, you know, my panelist counterpart that just spoke. There's been some economic choices that needs to be reversed, and then we will be able to make a lot of saving in the national budget, and that will improve definitely health and education policy, because President Macky Sall, whom I was his prime minister 10 years ago, invested much more in infrastructure than in building a social capital. So that needs to be reversed. And I can tell you that there are niches where you can save money and redirect those resources toward the people. So that's my first thing. The second thing is, I really share the vision of having Africa as one global space, but starting maybe by West Africa with ECOWAS, the ECOWAS space. We do have within ECOWAS Nigeria, that is the first economy in Africa before South Africa, before Egypt or Algeria. So this is a lack, and they are looking forward to a more integrated economic zone.
Aminata Touré, we're going to have to leave it there, but we'll continue this discussion. Senegal's former prime minister and Ibrahima Kane, Senegalese political analyst, speaking from Dakar. That does it for our show. Saturday night, I'll be speaking in Berkeley at KPFA's 75th anniversary celebration. Check our website at democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
Join me, Robin, every Friday at noon for Roots and Berries. Tune in to hear bluegrass, old-time music, and other rootsy little nuggets with a focus on Canadian players, singers, and pickers. That's Roots and Berries, Fridays over the noon hour, right here on CJSF 90.1 FM.
Indulge yourself in the cultural and folklore traditions of Italy on Il Sole Italiano every Sunday from 2 to 4 p.m.
Eravamo ancor fanciulli ogni sera su quel prato.
Hey folks, Joey KSC